Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this podcast. A couple of quick things before we kick off. First of all, we didn't mention it on the pod, so I'm mentioning it now. This episode plays out with a song called You'll Never Bury Palestine, performed by Irish Corkman Martin Leahy. So thanks to Martin for allowing us to use this song. We also need your support. The Tortoise Shack relies entirely on you, listeners, to pay it forward and keep it free for everyone. So if you're listening, if you like what we do, if you enjoy the podcast, maybe you enjoy Reboot Republic or the great conversations that the ladies are having on Musiclet, please join us. Help us keep the show on the road by clicking on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link is at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. It's the price of a fancy cup of coffee these days, but for us, it keeps the lights on, mics on, and we can continue to have conversations like the one you're about to listen to. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I'm shutting up now. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Palcast. This is Yusuf Jamal speaking to you from Istanbul. I'm very delighted to be joined by my great co-hosts, Helena Coben of Just Word Educational, who's joining us from Washington, D.C., and Tony Groves of the Tortoise Shack podcast, who's joining us from Dublin. Today is, and this is for the benefit of our listeners, is April 9th. And it's 6 p.m. here in Istanbul. Very good to speak to you again, Helena and Tony.
Good to see you, pal.
Good to be with you, Yusuf. And actually, everything we do here is for the benefit of our listeners.
Absolutely. Today is a very special day for Palestinian Muslims who observed the holy month of Ramadan, who fasted over 1 month, including Palestinians in Gaza. And tomorrow they're going to mark the first day of the Muslim feast, Eid al-Fitr. As we know, because of the genocide that started on October 7 in Gaza, Palestinians in Gaza will not be able to celebrate Eid, although there are people who are doing their best in tents in Gaza to celebrate Eid. And I remember I wrote an article for Just Word Educational about Eid in Gaza a few years ago, and I spoke about how my aunt would like make sure that the houses and streets around us are cleaned, and kids help her, and she would give them candies. And Eid in Gaza is very special, but it's very sad at the same time this year because of what happened. It's very special because Gaza is very tiny and crowded. You could easily spot kids wearing new clothes with their money, like going around with their pocket money, trying to buy stuff, food and toys. But again, it's very sad. Now we have more than 33,000 Palestinians from Gaza who were killed by Israel. And we have over 9,000 Palestinians who are under the rubble. And we will talk about a lot of things today. And I would like to start by highlighting Israel's withdrawal from Khan Yunis and the fact that once Israeli forces withdrew, Palestinians immediately found at least 80 bodies, decomposed bodies of Palestinians who were killed by Israeli snipers and Quad captors shooting at Palestinian drones and tanks. Crimes, it's just like unbelievable. It reminded me of the same scenes that we have seen after Israeli forces withdrew from Shifa Hospital.
Yeah, it's just terrible for everybody. It must be really particularly hard for you, Yusuf, and for all the many Palestinians from Gaza and elsewhere who are living in diaspora. You talked about your aunt at the time of the Eid and the children cleaning up the home. People don't have homes. I mean, now when people go back to Khan Yunis, they just see their apartment buildings pancake down into rubble on the decomposing bodies of their loved ones. I mean, I do not know how Palestinians can mark the Eid this year, but I hope everybody can somehow have a Eid Mubarak.
Just one quick thing on Eid Mubarak. It's just because I want to say it from a global perspective that the credit that went to some of Western governments, and particularly Joe Biden, when he said we want the ceasefire that will last for Ramadan, and here we are now at the end of Ramadan, and that hasn't taken place, even though they got the headline saying, you know, X, Y, and Z has demanded and has put these requests in. It just shows you how you know, time has not stood still. It's now 186 days, I think, of this genocidal campaign. And yeah, we spoke briefly before we came on air, and some of the things that are the news emerging from Khan Yunis is particularly gruesome, and there's no two ways about it. But Yusuf, I'd be interested in getting your, you know, what else are you hearing on the ground from people within Gaza at the moment?
I mean, I've been seeing the percentages of destruction in different areas, especially in Gaza City. The majority of neighborhoods were destroyed, either like the best case scenario of neighborhoods in Gaza got 60 to 70% of destruction, total Israeli destruction of homes. And we've talked previously about homicide and how Israel was intentionally doing that, and now they're bargaining and negotiating the return of displaced Palestinians to tents and camps. They still resist the idea that these Palestinians can go back to their destroyed homes. And the same thing happened in Khan Yunis. 45,000 houses were destroyed, which is about 55% of homes in the city. So the destruction is intentional. It's very clear. And, you know, once they leave, the crimes show. So we have multiple crimes of Palestinians being, you know, killed, including, I remember, a Palestinian woman around the Shifa Hospital. And her story came out again yesterday. 84-year-old Palestinian woman. She was found inside her house that was you know, completely burned by Israeli forces. Her remains were found on her bed, what remained of her bed. So that's, we're talking about, you know, this kind of crimes taking place in Gaza, in Khan Yunis. Entire houses, entire neighborhoods leveled to the ground intentionally. And not only this, you know, Israeli soldiers are bragging about the destruction of these homes. And then, you know, there are a lot of people who are missing. You cannot tell whether they were captured, because Israel is not transparent about the number and the names of people who they capture in Gaza. They're missing. No one knows. Are they under the rubble? Were they sniped down by quad captors or, you know, Israeli snipers? Were they targeted by drones, as we've seen? Now Israeli forces have left Khan Yunis because they failed to achieve their declared two goals, you know, capturing Hamas leaders or killing them, and releasing Israeli hostages. They managed to bring back the body of an Israeli hostage that was with the Islamic Jihad movement. Other than that, they did not do anything other than destroying homes.
And that body had been buried respectfully, as I understand it, by the people in whose care he was, unlike the many Palestinians whose bodies are found pancaked into the rubble. I think you made an important point about the Israeli government having not achieved either of its two goals. That is certainly coming through in the Israeli media a lot. You know, I read Haaretz and the Times of Israel, and it's becoming a huge issue inside the Israeli government right now, with these two ultra-right members of the cabinet, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gavir, saying that they insist on having a decision in the war-making cabinet because they say that Netanyahu has failed. So this is actually causing a huge political crisis inside Israel that we'll just have to see unfold over the days ahead. That's really important. Another thing I just want to put in is the matter of rebuilding. You know, every time in the past when Israel has launched an attack against Gaza from, you know, well, back to the 1990s and then 2000s and then, you know, from 2008, from 2014, whatever. After you get a ceasefire, then Israel has retained its military occupation of Gaza. That is control of all the borders, total control of what goes in and out of Gaza. This time it has to be different because the rebuilding effort will be so massive. That's why I've been arguing for a long while now that the United Nations needs to come in and say, we will do the reconstruction of Gaza and the Israeli military occupation of Gaza will hereby be ended once and for all. Israel has no right to be in Gaza after the genocide of the last 6 months. I just want to say I've been trying to count how many days Gaza has been under Israeli military occupation, and I think it's 18,570 days. So, you know, this military occupation has to end.
Just absolutely, and there's reports going around in Western medias of a Marshall Plan for Gaza, you know, and if listeners aren't familiar with that, that was the kind of post-World War II rebuilding that kick-started things in terms of the rebuilding mostly of European countries. But nonetheless, these are the type of things we are talking about. Something seismic has to happen. I mean, it is domicile. Don't take our word for it. The UN Special Rapporteur for Housing told us that on this podcast a few weeks ago, that it is domicile, the destruction of home. But I'm conscious of a couple of quick things, and I'd like Yusuf's input on this, because all week I've been hearing, you know, the reaction to the World Central Kitchen bombing, how that continued to change the dynamic. Obviously, there's a lot of systemic racism and how it was looked upon when it was these people were horribly killed, and like there's no excuse for that. But the world's reaction was very different. But it was also another interesting thing was where, you know, Israel announced then, oh, and we've now reopened the Erez crossing, having said that they weren't stopping aid getting into Gaza. Like, you know, it can't be one or can't be the other. But Yusuf, it must have been picked up by the Palestinian community that, as horrible as it is, in the same way as we see how Ukrainian refugees are treated differently, this is another example of how there's just doesn't matter as much if people are brown.
No, absolutely. Before getting into this point, I would like just to point to UN report that just came out on April 8, prepared by the United Nations Conference for Trade and Development, that says we need 70 years to bring Gaza back to normal, to what used to be Gaza in terms of GDP and development. And, you know, these are horrifying statistics and numbers. 70% of the northern part of Gaza has been destroyed. 50% of the entire Gaza Strip, homes in the infrastructure in the Gaza Strip has been destroyed. To get back to your question and, you know, the issue of racism, we've seen it. You mentioned Ukraine, and I remember how, you know, Ukrainian refugees were received. I sympathize with any refugee in the world growing up in a refugee camp, attending, you know, schools by the United, run by the United Nations. So I know what it means to grow up in a refugee camp and to be a refugee. But absolutely, there is racism, even when it comes to the issue of, you know, skin color. I remember the mother of Ahad Tamimi saying that the reason she got Western media attention is because of the color of her eyes and her blonde hair. So this is real. We've been dealing with this as Palestinians for many years. There was a crime committed against 7-8 workers. One of them is Palestinian dual citizen. The rest are non-Palestinians. And we've seen the international cry. This brought about some positive change finally to Gaza. So we're happy with the positive change. But the way it happened, why did the world wait, you know, as you said, Tony, 186 days? 33,000, Palestinians killed and huge destruction of Gaza to pressure Israel to allow more aid trucks. This is very simple and it's very disgusting at the same time. I have my own criticism of the World Central Kitchen. I believe that Israel is planning to replace UNRWA by bringing international aid organizations to work in Gaza. But this is a different issue. We can talk about it. We never justify the killing of aid workers by Israel. And the reaction of the international community, so-called international community, was huge. Why? Because foreigners were killed, not Palestinians. That's fine. Like, they can kill thousands of Palestinians. The U.S. was talking about high number of Palestinians being killed on daily basis. At the time, it was 150 per day. Today, we're talking about 70 to 80. It seems that the criticism of the United States is much less. It seems that this is the acceptable number of daily Palestinians killed by Israel. We never justify and accept the killing of a single Palestinian or non-Palestinian anywhere in the world. And this is very clear.
Yusuf, I have a question about these trucks that I saw going in yesterday through the Erez crossing or otherwise reaching northern Gaza, which is great. I just wish that they could take in like houses and schools and water treatment plants and everything that the people need, but at least having food is a basic. I saw men dressed in black uniforms riding on top of the cargoes of some of these trucks, and I wondered: are these Jordanians, unarmed security officers? Are they PA people? Who are they?
I'm not definitely sure. So, in the past, over the past week, there was a group of PA officers who came with convoys, aid convoys, and they were arrested by Hamas in the north of Gaza. In the south of Gaza, some of them were arrested as well. And they accused them of, collaborating with Israel and like conveying some information to the Israeli security. The fact that these aid trucks came from the north of Gaza, not from Egypt, and then through the south of Gaza, where Hamas has, some sort of authority and power, and they can control these aid trucks, it's very hard to tell who these people were. And that's why, Israel decided to let these aid trucks to come from the north of Gaza so that they can directly give them to Palestinians there without having to deal with Hamas or UNRWA. They could be, as you said, like people working with the PA in Gaza or some Jordanian, I'm not sure, like Arab, Jordanian, Egyptian security forces or personnel who are trying to safeguard these. They could be also locals. There are some local tribes and leaders. There could be some sort of agreement. I have to investigate that now, but there could be an agreement between local leaders and Hamas authorities and UNRWA to bring these people, because this was the case when some aid trucks entered the north of Gaza from the south. The whole process was coordinated by families under the supervision of Hamas and UNRWA. So this is also a possibility. But as you said, it's a positive development that finally a good number of aid trucks is making it to the north of Gaza. Yesterday, I spoke to someone I worked with in the past at the Hashem Sani Center, Hashem Sani Library in Gaza. And he told me one word. So this is the story for people to understand what's going on, not just food-wise. But my friend Ahmed is in Shija'iyah. His wife is in Deir al-Balah. So Ahmed is in the north of Gaza, in Gaza City. And his wife is in the south of Gaza. She just gave birth and they are separated. And this is, he told me one word: the situation is disastrous.
Just on that report, Helena, just to read what is actually in the public domain, and again, according to Haaretz, that some incidents follow two others, one in which the north and one in the south. in which Hamas did kill a clan leader who was involved in attempts to receive convoys by bypassing the militant group. So that's the reporting that's come out on that. But again,
Well, reporting in
exactly. I'm only here just reading from the actual script here, as they say, you know. But look, it's.
I mean, I hope the United Nations. I mean, what's his name? Jamie McGoldrick has been in the north of Gaza from the UN OCHA, and I hope that they can put together some kind of a coalition that works.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just a couple of things that are going to start happening in the next little while. We had Chris Andrews talking about the need for blockade, particularly when it comes to sport. The Olympics is not far away. We need to. We definitely need to see some pressure there. And we've seen actually the. I know it means very little to most people, but the Eurovision is coming up as well, and that's in a matter of days. And unfortunately, from an Irish perspective, our contestant, for want of a better term, Bambi Tug, who I have no problems whatsoever, but has decided to go along anyway. And the gesture that she has made is, you know, painting Palestinian flags on her nails, and on she'll wear a certain garb to as a form of protest. Personally, I'd have preferred you didn't go at all. As a sign of solidarity. But so I know it's simple, but a lot of that sort of stuff is actually, it's funny, we said 186 days. I think there's another international day of protest, I think on the 21st of April. It does seem to still be continuing, like it hasn't faded, Helena. Like the streets,
Absolutely. I saw one for April 15th that's being called. And actually, you mentioned the Olympics coming up, I think, in June in Paris. Interestingly, today in the Washington Post, there's an article that is co-authored by President Emmanuel Macron, El-Sisi of Egypt, and His Majesty, the King Abdullah II of Jordan. So these three leaders are calling openly in the Washington Post for a ceasefire. I think that's interesting, you know, because Macron's position has been here and there, but I think he seems to be focusing more on the need for a ceasefire, which I welcome. It's great to have the support of as many West European governments as possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a new Taoiseach only in the last few hours, and I don't know if you saw any, but he did actually on his first speech when he took over Fine Gael, his party, he said President Netanyahu, the Irish people are disgusted by what you are doing. And it was pretty strong language. Now, again, we'd rather more substance behind those words, but it was pretty strong to call the behavior disgusting. I think, you know, so that was something.
I think they used the word repulsed.
Yeah, we're repulsed by you. Yeah, which is again, Yusuf. It's. You know, it's sad to say, but it just shows even in Ireland, we're not particularly blown away by our own acts, yet we're still doing more, saying more than some other nations who have much more clout, shall we say.
Yes, absolutely. There are also some developments. So when in the past, we talked about some European countries such as Spain, Slovenia, and Belgium, planning to recognize the Palestinian state in the summer. Mm-hmm. And today there was a statement by the foreign minister of Australia saying the only solution is to recognize a Palestinian state. So there is more calls for, you know, international calls for, you know, recognition of a Palestinian state, which is positive. At the same time, here in Turkey, there were criticisms for the Turkish government for the trade ties that Turkey has with Israel. And this was clear in the most recent local elections held on March 31st, where the ruling party lost its votes and local councils that it was running. They call them Baladia here. major beldiyas were lost by the ruling party because of ties to Israel, trade ties to Israel. So a lot of conservative people chose not to vote for the Development and Justice Party. And it seems that they started to get the message. Finally, yesterday, there was a statement by the foreign minister of Turkey, Hakan Fidan, saying that Turkey will ban the export of 45 items to Israel. And today, the Israeli foreign minister responded saying that they will also stop getting stuff and goods from Turkey. So there is more international pressure finally on Israel on this front.
Yeah, the trade thing is interesting. I see lots of trade links are being broken. And actually, I don't know if this registered with you at all, but in Ireland, there's a company called Web Summit, which hosts the largest tech summits across the world, whether they be in Lisbon, Brazil, Qatar, Canada. We're all of these huge tech companies get together. And at the beginning of the conflict, and I use that word loosely, the CEO of Web Summit had to resign because he tweeted about, you know, war crimes were war crimes no matter who committed them, and he was seen to be too, you know, being too critical of Israel and you know, not condemning Hamas strongly enough. You might have missed the news, but yesterday he returned as CEO of the company. Despite the last, when he stood down, there was international outcry for, you know, get rid of him because of, you know, you couldn't say anything bad about Israel. And now there's nobody talking about his return because, I hate to say it, but after 186 days, what he said now speaks much truer. And the companies that were, you know, didn't want to be associated with the Web Summit, they've all kind of decided, well, actually, it turns out 33,000 dead Palestinians is too much, and you know he wasn't wrong 6 months ago. So I find that interesting that, you know, business is changing its tune. Like McDonald's, I don't know if you saw this, Yusuf. McDonald's buying all of their stores, all the franchises in Israel because the boycott is hurting McDonald's profits. It's interesting that it's working.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the power of people. And when people get together, all these capitalist companies and enterprises cannot stand there for too long. They cannot challenge the power of people. And it's a message that normal people, just like, you know, ordinary guys on the street, can do something. And this is powerful. It's also a message to governments. If you mess up, we also have, you know, our own tools and powers. We have boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And we spoke previously about the history of boycott. It resonates with people from South Africa to Ireland to Palestine. And now we have more legal efforts by, I think, was it Nicaragua?
Nicaragua taking Germany to the ICJ.
Yes, for providing Israel with weapons. So, you know, Gaza has changed the world. There are a lot of developments taking place. Although Gaza is a tiny, you know, coastal enclave territory, the impact that, you know, it created across the globe, the shock waves are still, you know, very clear. And we see, you know, a new development every day, as I said. So Germany is being taken by Nicaragua. And it's very ironic because this comes at a time when Rwanda is marking the 30-year anniversary of the genocide against the Tutsi, which, again, you know, we live in a world of irony. And speaking of irony, our great friend Rifat Al-Ar'ir liked irony and pun. We had the Israeli president attending these celebrations and say, this is horrible. It shouldn't happen. He's saying this as his own country is committing a literal genocide in Gaza. And this is the guy who, you know, wrote on shells that were fired into Gaza. There's a picture of him writing messages on shells. One of them fell on my family's home. So we live in a world of irony, but also intersectional solidarity.
Yeah, but when you say, you know, like we saw Ursula von der Leyen, you know, talking about the anniversary of the Rwanda genocide and the lessons that had to be learned. And this is, again, the European president who traveled to Israel to embrace Benjamin Netanyahu and give the EU's unequivocal support without the blessing of the European people. Like, you know, it is a, she's not democratically elected. She's elected by a corporate entity in effect in many ways, you know. So it's just, it is crazy to sit there and watch it. And I've been thinking a lot about Rifat this week because, first of all, because you miss him. And second of all, because he would have thought, you know, he would have said some seriously strong comments on social media about the people who are, you know, carrying out this hypocrisy, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouths, as we say. And he would have not been kind to Ursula von der Leyen or anybody else who was preaching one thing about Rwanda and then supporting what's happening in Gaza. So yeah, I've missed him a lot this week because I found myself reading all messages. How about you?
I miss him a lot. And today I was reading the Arabic translation of a journal article he wrote about Gaza Rights Back. It's titled Gaza Rights Back, Narrating Palestine. It was translated by Dr. Abdulrahim Sheikh from Birzeit University in the West Bank and published. The Arabic translation was just published by the Journal of Palestine Studies, the Arabic version of the journal in Lebanon, Beirut. And, you know, Rifat still lives through his words. I see him everywhere on social media, even though it's been 5 months since he was killed. People are still, you know, reciting his poetry, quoting his words and remembering him. So the strong legacy, very powerful legacy he created, makes us, although we miss him, it makes us feel satisfied that he was not killed in vain, as he wanted in his, you know, poem when he said, if I must die, you must live to tell my story. There are a lot of people who are telling Rifat's stories, and, you know, we miss him every day.
Look, I didn't mean to, don't want to get emotional, but yeah, I just thought this week I would have seen him on social media absolutely roasting people for their hypocrisy, and you know, you miss that attitude. And but look, yeah, no, thanks again. But we will be covering more aspects from the diaspora as we go. We'll have more guests lined up. Yusuf's been obviously doing a great job in bringing people on board. We wouldn't mind some feedback if you want to let us know who you might want us to talk to. So that'd be great. You're more than welcome to if you can email me at info@tortoiseshack.ie, or you can get us on social media. You can get us on our Twitter accounts, unfortunately, or X or whatever it's called nowadays. And if you want to give us some feedback, we'd be more than happy to listen and take it on board. But yeah, look, thanks so much, Yusuf. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony. I just updated my phone. There was a new update by Apple, and it says subtitles are now available for podcasts. So this is great news. I know that people wouldn't like prefer to listen to things, but sometimes when you have the writings on the screen too, it helps. I would like to also thank you and Helena and our great co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya. Looking forward to speaking to you next week and bringing in more guests, as you said, to highlight the perspective of Palestinians in the diaspora on what's happening in Gaza. And I wish every single Palestinian in Gaza a happy Eid. And we reiterate our call for immediate, effective ceasefire.
Everyone will see crimes against humanity. Leaders looked away from a live stream genocide. Trucks are filled with food supplies, kept outside, telling us that black is white, but the world is seeing right through Israeli lies. Using the weapon of hunger, life is a game to these monsters who would starve a child. Every day they're losing. losing their lives. Death raining down from a mysterious sky, fleeing from their homes, waiting to die by the gun of an evil, twisted Zionist mind. But with all the guns and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. Palestine. Mocking victims for the world to see, sickening scenes on TikTok streams, the moral rot and the souls of the IDF. Using the weapon of hunger, life is a gain to these monsters who would starve a child. Every day they're losing their lives, death raining down from a mysterious sky, fleeing from their homes, waiting to die by the gun of an evil, twisted Zionist mind. But with all the guns and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. But with all the tanks and bombs you design, you will never bury Palestine. Palestine.